9. Battle cry. Sleep comes at long last in the cell of a dormitory unit of the Dallas County Jail, North Tower, where Haley mercifully finds solitude and relative safety behind a time-locked door. Knocked flat by the car bomb's blast and possibly concussed, she was arrested by detectives from the Richardson Police Department. The busboy who had witnessed her brutal interrogation of Cecil Drummond provided police with a detailed description of the crazy woman in the Honey Springs meeting room. Charged with aggravated assault, Haley Chill suspects the storm has already made arrangements for her execution. Sunday is her 7th day in West Texas, but will be one of little rest. The tank has 14 cells, with a day room and lavatory shower. Haley arrived at 8 p.m. the previous evening and kept to herself in the otherwise unoccupied cell. Only after lights out and the sound of automatic door locks engaged did she finally close her eyes. Those same locks open at 7 a.m. the following morning. Whoever tried to kill her with the car bomb won't stop after one failed attempt. Haley assumes trouble will come in the day room or lavatory just off that unit's central area. She had reached out to Andrew Wilde before the police confiscated her phone, and left a message. When and if Publius can free her before she's killed is an anxiety Haley tries to suppress. Until then, survival is her own responsibility. The other inmates have been up and out of their cells for more than 2 hours before Haley's need for the bathroom necessitates leaving her sanctuary. All eyes fall on the deeper state operative as she enters the day room, wearing jail-issued blue coveralls and flip-flops. Haley assumes all of the other women in the tank are, like her, charged with violent offenses. They certainly have that appearance, brazenly watching the new inmate with predatory gazes intended to intimidate. The filth and disrepair of the facility is impossible to miss. A male correctional officer occupies a protected cubicle, the pod, at one end of the day room. Ignoring the other hard looks, Haley focuses instead on the doorway that leads into the bathroom. She finds no other inmate inside. There are no stalls, of course. Sitting on the toilet farthest from the doorway, Haley is grateful to have gotten some sleep the previous night. Arriving at the jail, she felt at the end of her rope, depleted and emotionally frayed. With rest, however, she feels more like herself, psychologically and physically renewed, ready for the worst of what Lou Stare at North Tower can throw at her. Haley stands up from the toilet as the two inmates enter the bathroom and walk directly at her. Both women hold their right hands down and slightly behind them, leading with their left hands out. The deeper state operative assumes their other hands hold shanks. She has no way to evade the attack she knows is coming. There's no time to confirm their intentions or the existence of weapons. Raising both hands, Haley centers on the larger of the two inmates. As the woman draws within range, she reaches with her left, leveraging hand to grab hold of Haley and pull her toward the shank, a sharpened toothbrush that only now appears in her lowered right hand. Haley traps the woman's knife hand, guiding it away while driving her knee into her attacker's abdomen. Then she spins the woman in the direction of the other inmate, who has simultaneously launched her attack by raising her shank overhead. The first woman absorbs two blows of the makeshift knife before her cohort realizes her mistake. Both thrusts hit the first inmate on the back of her neck, piercing the least resistant part of the skull at the squamous part of the temporal bone. These violent stabbing wounds completely sever the brainstem and basilar artery. The first inmate drops to her knees and falls over, leaking blood and mortally injured. Haley faces off with the remaining attacker, who adopts a more measured strategy now that her adversary has proved herself an adept fighter. The deeper state operative experiences a moment of optimism, having achieved some parity. But it's brief. She sees three more inmates enter the bathroom. None appear eager to stop the fight. To the contrary, the other women are without question reinforcements of the first two. At least I can go down fighting. Haley centers her weight over her feet as the prisoners converge on her position. Take out the biggest first, she strategizes. Maybe I can scare off the more diffident ones. No one makes a move to help the injured woman on the filthy, piss-stained bathroom floor, bleeding out from her neck wound and thrashing around in the throes of her demise. Her story is over. Haley savors one last second of tranquility before the onslaught of violence. One last breath. There will be more bloodshed. Soon, there will be death.
What the hell's going on in here?
The voice, male, authoritative, pissed off, comes from behind the female inmates. It belongs to the pod officer, come to retrieve the newest inmate in the unit. Come to fetch Haley Chill. Andrew Wilde takes her to eat at Slowbone, more of an insider's hang than one of the more touristy barbecue joints in town. Most of the customers, both white and black, are wearing their best church clothes. Haley's deeper state superior manages to eat a half rack of pork ribs without so much as the slightest smear of sauce on his face or hands. Dressed, as usual, in what must be one of a dozen blue suits, Wilde's bland emotions and placid expression betray no sign of concern over the traumatic events in his operative's past 18 hours. Haley pauses over her plate of skinless chicken thighs to watch her boss polish a rib bone clean. "Can I ask you a question, sir?" He twists off another succulent rib from what remains of the rack. "Shoot. Are you ever not tan?" His color is indeed a wholly unnatural shade of orange. Haley has speculated whether the soles of her superior's feet are similarly bronzed. The question fails to register with Wilde, who gestures at Haley with the pork rib held confidently between his index finger and thumb.
"We're bringing you out."
"What?" She thinks he's joshing. It dawns on her that he's entirely serious. "Why?"
"Because they're running out of body bags down here. That's why."
"Mr. Wilde."
"Not open to discussion, Chill. You've left quite a swath of destruction in your wake. How many more messes do you expect us to clean up after you?"
"I'm making progress, sir. These people are advocating separation from the United States. Their goal is the creation of a nation built on a foundation of white supremacy." She gestures at her cell phone on the table. "You saw the recording of Drummond's presentation."
"Come on. Texans have been talking secessionism since there was a Texas. Bunch of wingnuts. We have files on this already. It's nothing new."
By we, Haley assumes he means Publius. "Sir, what if the sabotage events in the Permian Basin were just a ruse to get the National Guard deployed there? That's hardly theoretical grandstanding. What was started with the storming of the Capitol gets finished here, in West Texas."
Wilde scoffs. "A few elements from the National Guard are going to affect the military occupation of 86,000 square miles of territory? A region inhabited by a bunch of ornery, pissed-off Texans?"
"Then what are they doing there?" asks Haley.
"Besides staging bare-knuckle fistfights, I'm not sure. And I don't care. Your antics have made it difficult for Senator Powell to preserve any semblance of legitimacy. He's asked that you no longer be associated with his office in any capacity." He drops the rib bone in the basket and wipes his fingers on a napkin. "In other words, Chill, you've been fired from the job you never had."
Haley goes quiet. She knows from experience that there's no point arguing with Andrew Wilde.
He says, "We're still working on the authorities in New Mexico. Now this business in Dallas. Despite my best efforts, you can't leave the state just yet."
She remains silent, sensing an opening.
"Go back to El Paso.
Sit tight." Haley lifts her gaze to meet his. A lingering glance they exchange transmits a message of some significance. Andrew Wilde's typically mild expression seems to perk up, a lightness in his eyes.
He says, "Cheer up. You're going home soon. What's your final verdict on the hush puppies? West Virginia girl is the expert on down-home cooking. Up to snuff, Chill?"
The deeper state operative nods. She suspects that her boss is wired. Another layer of surveillance. One more version of not being able to trust anyone in this business. He has delivered the official decision from his superiors within the deeper state. But she fully comprehends his unspoken desire. Andrew Wilde wants her to keep going.
"The hush puppies were pretty damn good, sir."
Oswald hears the news from Dallas after leaving the meeting at the ranch and is already halfway through the long drive to Austin. His lower back is killing him, and he hasn't been able to take a decent shit in 3 days. He wonders at times if he is too old for all of this.
too old for an active role in the Second Civil War. On the other hand, however, he cannot imagine sitting this one out. Of all the wars and battles in which he has shed blood and sweat, never tears. The aspirations of this fight are too grand. A once-in-a-lifetime chance to be James Woodside's Himmler. Is he a firm proponent of the racist philosophies of the majority of conspirators? Not particularly. Oswald knows why he is here, lower back issues or not. To make history. The death of one of the movement's best fundraisers is a blow, but certainly survivable. The bulk of the conspiracy's underwriting comes from a Texas-based multi-billionaire entrepreneur and recent refugee from the socialist state of California. Drummond's work was an ongoing effort to match the mercurial and headstrong billionaire's investments, in case he suddenly decamped for even more laissez-faire environs like Switzerland. Or Mars, for that matter. In any event, plenty of candidates are prepared to take Cecil Drummond's place. Any public exposure that arises because of the incident is of small consequence, too. With the operation well underway, events will soon outpace any future investigations mounted by local authorities. In only a matter of hours, the FSA will be in charge. What remains a significant concern is Haley Chill, if that is indeed her true identity. With her survival of two assassination attempts, Oswald now understands that the young woman is something more than a lowly Senate aide. Other conspirators have queried FBI agents sympathetic to the cause. They confirmed that the young woman isn't an undercover operative from that federal agency. If not with the Bureau, then what? And how to explain her tenacity? The woman operates as if on a personal mission, relentless in her pursuit of the Storm's hierarchy. He can't help but be intrigued by her, and impressed. It's a shame, then, that he must kill her. Getting to know something of Haley Chill's story would have been preferable, to understand what makes her tick. A call comes not long after the first, informing him that the Senate aide has boarded a flight at DFW. Oswald wastes no time making a series of calls that allow him to change directions on the interstate and head west again, back toward El Paso. He was on his way for an overnight trip to Austin to monitor an operation that will culminate in the arrest and detention of the governor, then immediately return to the Permian Basin midday tomorrow. That responsibility will now be delegated to others. If someone must kill her, then he is the man to do the job. As a Marine raider who saw action in Iraq during the earliest years of the war there, followed by a decade with the CIA's old Special Activities Division, Oswald has the experience and skill set to get the job done. Nearing 60 years of age, he thought all that wet work was behind him. His duties with the Storm have been more supervisory, and he's been okay with that. But the blonde-haired Senate aide has stirred a longing in him, a desire long dormant. Monumental shifts are afoot. Most of America eases blithely into its Sunday evening without awareness of the machinations now in place to irrevocably alter her. As he drives west, Peter Oswald experiences the delectable surge of bloodlust, the entrance of a worthy adversary into the arena. He must kill Haley Chill, if only to prove his mettle. Returning to the Beverly Crest Motor Inn after 10 that night, she isn't surprised to find April Wu gone. Haley can't imagine her former colleague's frustration. What to do with all of the downtime? Being reduced to the role of spectator. For an alpha female like April, the inactivity must be torture. Haley has enormous sympathy for her friend and misses their rivalry as Publius's preeminent covert agents. At the same time, however, the deeper state operative is relieved to find her motel room empty. She isn't in the mood for putting up with April's needling questions. The sardonic observations that pick apart Haley's motivations and lay bare her emotional incapacities. Her personal failures. Sam McGovern. The unplanned pregnancy. Haley returned to El Paso with little more than the clothes on her back, of course. Her tote bag was destroyed in the car bomb blast. She was fortunate to have held onto her phone. The rental agency representative met her at the airport with replacement keys for the car Haley had left in the parking lot. She lost her tablet in the explosion, but nothing else of significance. Along with the Warhawk, Haley left her father's coded document behind in her motel room, behind the vent and past a turn of the heating duct. Retrieving the items, she flips through the pages of cryptic passages. Will she ever decipher their meaning? Haley hides the envelope again. She is at a crossroads. Whoever occupies the deeper state's command level has decided to end her investigation of the storm. Andrew Wilde faithfully delivered that order, but with the implicit understanding that he was giving her a way to remain in the game, without the deeper state support. She's on her own. Haley enters the bathroom. The prescription bottle is nestled inside her open toiletry travel bag where she left it. Almost dying, twice, in the last 24 hours, has had a strangely calming effect on her. She feels strong. Not invincible, but extraordinarily capable. What circumstances seemed impossible only a few days before now appear less monumentally intolerable. No one can question her dedication to Publius, to her country. Retrieving the vial from the travel bag, Haley uncaps it and dumps the 8 tablets of misoprostol into the toilet, flushing it for good measure. She then climbs into bed, checks to see that the Warhawk is loaded with a round in the chamber, and slides the gun under her pillow. Haley is fully asleep within 60 seconds of lying down. Oswald is across the street, sitting behind the wheel of his pickup truck and keeping an eye on the motel room. On the passenger seat next to him is a standard Colt M45A1 CQBP pistol. Though not the M45 Musaq model he had carried while a Marine raider in Afghanistan, the M45A1 was its official replacement in 2012 and familiar enough for Oswald's daily carry. His old Colt had gotten him out of plenty of jams during his 2 tours with the Marines Special Forces, and he feels a strong loyalty to the manufacturer and its reliability. He intends to wait 90 minutes since lights out inside Haley Chill's room, and then enter using a master key derived by hacking the Vision software used in hotel locking systems worldwide. He considers the possibility of interrogating his target before executing her, shooting her in the head through a pillow to muffle the sound, but doesn't count on having that opportunity. Oswald imagines she has taken the precaution of keeping a weapon within reach as she sleeps. If Haley Chill makes any move for a gun, he'll shoot her where she lies and then run like hell. The Senate aide has earned his respect. The lights were turned off more than an hour ago. Oswald is ready. He watches the motel parking lot and periodically checks the same Casio G-Shock DW6900 wristwatch he's had for 15 years, purchased between deployments. Oswald feels sentimental toward the cheap timepiece and considers it something of a good luck charm. 3 minutes to jump off. Oswald puts eyes back on the motel parking lot. An older Latino man leaves the sidewalk, a pouch slung over his shoulder. He approaches the nearest parked car in the lot and slips a leaflet under the windshield wiper. Withdrawing another circular, the man, in his 60s, though the dim light makes a confident guess nearly impossible, continues to the next car and repeats the process until he's leafleted every vehicle in the lot. He turns now and approaches the street again. The man locks eyes with Oswald sitting in his car across the street and turns in his direction. Juan Lugo, in his late 60s, has lived in West Texas his entire life, 20 years of which were spent working on the JW7 ranch near Balmoray. He walks with a proud, erect gait, his straw hat crisp and clean despite the countless hours spent under a relentless sun. Clearly, Lugo wants a word with the gringo dressed in black sitting behind the wheel of his vehicle, stopped directly across the street from the motel. At this hour, they are the only people present in a world that seems all post-apocalyptic. Oswald only has a few seconds to make his decision. Should he kill the man there in the street and continue with his original plan, or should he abort the mission and leave now? Simply waving him off is not an option. The man could be questioned eventually by the police and identify Oswald or his vehicle. Shooting him would leave a body in the street while he carries out the hit on Haley Chill, an agonizing span of time to be exposed and vulnerable. Attempting to move his body runs the risk of creating additional incriminating evidence. What to do? Oswald realizes, with not a small amount of shame, that his indecision is just another indication of his age-degrading operational performance. He frets that he won't live long enough to truly enjoy the fruits of his labors.
to fully enjoy his status as a revolutionary hero and potential founding father of a new nation. If only he were 10 or 15 years younger. As the leafleting Juan Lugo closes the distance between them, Oswald hits the ignition and pulls away at high speed. Of all the fucking bad luck. The next morning, Haley makes the short drive to the base. On the seat next to her is the flyer she removed from her windshield. Kimberly. Still missing. Black hair and dark eyes, wearing a navy UTEP hoodie. 15 years old. Her family has increased the reward for information leading to her recovery to $10,000. Seeing the flyer again, a constant motif since her arrival in El Paso, only stokes her growing outrage. The higher she has climbed in her furious ascent of the storm's hierarchy, the graver her descent into what Haley perceives as a corruption of the country's ideals, what it is to be an American, and why the people of the United States should form a more perfect union. The leaflet for the missing teenage girl, like a constant drumbeat of despair that keeps time with Haley's unyielding investigation, is a reminder that suffering and loss are everywhere around her. The missing girl might seem insignificant compared to civil war, but Haley Chill can't avoid sensing a connection between these two disparate incidents. By what correlation, however? She might ponder it longer, but not a quarter mile after leaving the motel, she sees the familiarly old and battered Ford F-150 following her. There are two vehicles between her and her pursuer, but the deeper state operative is able to make out the license plate. She remembers it, of course. After seeing the man in black sitting in the pickup across the street from the motel on Saturday morning, Haley had sent the plate number to Wild. The answer that came back wasn't useful. The Ford was registered to an 82-year-old widow in Kermit who lives alone. The man driving the truck, white, in his late 50s or early 60s, had either stolen the vehicle or bought it without title transfer. Cash transaction. Off the books. That's one way to do it. Seeing him back there and not making much effort to conceal himself only pisses Haley off more. And it's not even 8 in the morning. He returned to the Beverly Crest Motor Inn a little after sunrise. Seeing her car in the lot, Oswald waited halfway down the block, made some calls, checked in via text messages with some of Storm's other supervisory captains. He regrets missing out on taking down the governor. Fucking guy wasn't even born in Texas. Yeah, that's going to be a real party. Oswald's lieutenant, who has inherited the operation, promised to get the whole thing on video. The look on that oaky son of a bitch's face when they come for him is going to be priceless. Missing out on that piece of business gives Pete Oswald another reason to hate Haley Chill, or whatever her real name is. His plan is simple enough. Oswald intends to drop the hammer on the purported Senate aide before she gets to Fort Bliss. Taking her out while she's on the post isn't an option. Oswald can't even get past the gates. No, the time is now. Pull up alongside her at a stoplight and start blasting Mexican cartel style. He'll have to ditch the truck, but the old biddy who sold it to him for $2,000 won't have much of anything actionable to say about him. Nice white man, 50s maybe. Did I mention he was awful nice? But then, just like that, Oswald loses sight of her rental car. For some reason, she had stayed on Dyer instead of hopping on southbound Gateway Boulevard. Had she spotted him following her? Passing the high school on his left, he can't locate Haley Chill's rental car anywhere on the 6-lane divided road. He's passing through the light at Ellerthorpe Avenue when the impact from the rear of his vehicle causes his head to pitch forward and smack the top of the steering wheel. Haley had taken advantage of a slight bend in the road just before passing underneath the freeway to speed ahead and take a hard right, cutting off 2 lanes of oncoming traffic, to enter the high school grounds. Via the school road, speeding past sports fields and parking lots, she was able to re-enter southbound lanes on Dyer and fall in behind the F-150 unnoticed. Haley could see her pursuer behind the wheel of the beat-to-shit Ford pickup truck, his head swiveling from left to right in search of her. She waited until he merged into the right-hand lane before accelerating and bashing into the rear bumper of the pickup. When Haley gets to the open driver's window, both vehicles stopped in the right lane, cars whizzing past behind them. They have each other dead to rights.
with their respective 1911 handguns held at point-blank range. Pulling the trigger is as good as suicide. Oswald asks,
"Who the fuck are you?"
I was going to ask you the same question.
"Who do you work for? What do you want?"
Haley says, "You first." His eyes take in the magnificent, clean lines of the Nighthawk 45 caliber 1911 pointed at his head. A more impressive weapon than his Colt, at least if measured by purchase price. Oswald's 1911 costs a quarter of the custom handgun in Haley's grip.
"Fancy gun. Too big in your hands?"
"Ask your friends in New Mexico." Oswald's mouth forms a perfect O. So she did make him from more than a quarter mile off. "How?" She interrupts his idle speculation with, "I already know more than you think."
"But you don't have it all. I don't even have the whole picture."
Haley wonders if this guy knew her father. Odds are they both walk away from this, or they both die. She entertains no illusion of taking her adversary into custody, not now, not this morning. The deeper state operative has a bigger fish on the line. No doubt the man in black has done his due diligence and most likely knows her name. He probably thinks it's made up, just like everything else he'd learned about her. Funny, huh? Haley decides to split the difference.
"Did you know Charlie Hicks?"
Watching his face for a reaction, and intentionally not asking about Tommy Chill. Oswald's face remains impassive.
"Never heard of him. My turn?"
"You don't get a turn." He scoffs and shakes his head.
"You remind me of my kid sister. She was a pain in the ass, too."
"I like her already." A passing Good Samaritan slows to a near stop, his passenger side window down. The smoke from his cigarette wafts out of his brand new Ford pickup truck with a languid insouciance.
"You folks need a hand?"
the Good Samaritan asks from behind all of that blue smoke. Oswald glares at the man with an impatient menace that prompts quick reconsideration. Soon enough, he and Haley have the shoulder of the road to themselves again.
"She was the one with the grades. Apple of the old man's eye," he says, furiously scratching his chin. "My parents didn't even try to encourage me to go to college. Marines was good enough for me. Let her be the good one. Getting into trouble was more fun. And even as a kid, Amy had to be the cop, the moralist. Used to follow me, keep tabs on her fuck-up big brother and report back to Dad. This one time, Amy sees that I'd taken the shotgun out of the old man's closet. Follows me in her car, right? My friends and I were going to boost the local McDonald's. When my sister figured out what was going down, she went inside to warn the burger flippers. Told them not to answer any knock at the back door. That we were out there with our ski masks and shotgun. I didn't realize it until later why no one ever came to the door, when she told me that she'd ratted us out. My sister. She had the same expression on her face that you do now. Like she knew she was better. That she would always be better."
The muscles in his face set like concrete. The bitterness still fresh all these years later. Oswald says,
"Too bad one of my buddies found out what she'd done. I hated what happened to Amy after that. The old man, he was just brokenhearted."
Haley says nothing. The wind created by the cars rushing past her is infused with grit and sand from miles of desert in every direction. A stray dog scurries over the rock-strewn frontage area bordering the road, beneath a sky clogged with ominous clouds. How did she not hear about a storm in the forecast?
"Wherever you come from, go back. Leave this alone," he says, his words knocking her out of her split-second reverie. "You know what happens to good girls." This dude doesn't have a freaking clue.
She says, "I got some advice for you, too." Oswald raises his eyebrows by way of inquiry. Haley shoots her left hand into the car, rips the key from the ignition, and says, "Don't be such a perfect shit." With her left fist clutching the truck's ignition key, she punches him in the right eye. "That's for Amy." Haley leaves the window and walks quickly back to her idling rental car.
She finds Roy Pogue in a treatment cubicle at the emergency center of the Beaumont Army Medical Center. The last time she was at this hospital, Haley watched Christian Libby jump over the low wall on the building's rooftop. Feels like ages ago, though only 4 days have passed since that event. The CID agent sits on the examination table while a young Army doctor stitches up a nasty gash on the right side of his head, just above the ear. Nursing staff have yet to clean his neck of dried blood. He can't suppress a baleful expression.
They got me in the parking lot of a Starbucks on Lee Trevino.
They? Haley asks. She learned Pogue had been assaulted and was receiving treatment when she called his office just before passing through the Cassidy Gate.
Three guys.
Military? Pogue shrugs.
I didn't recognize any of them.
White men, sir? The young captain wearing scrubs shoots her a glance.
We almost done here?
The CID agent asks the doctor, pointedly ignoring Haley. Low, dark clouds threaten rain. Wind whips in one direction and then another, kicking up dirt and debris. Temperature spiking and then dropping again within an hour or two. Weird weather in many places, but not West Texas. Haley and Pogue walk in the hospital lot toward her car. I know who's in charge. The CID agent seems less than thrilled to hear Haley's announcement.
In charge of what? He asks testily.
Mr. Pogue, I witnessed a sales pitch in Dallas to potential investors for a proposed nation to be carved from Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and parts of Kansas and Arizona. A secessionist movement, sir, founded on a political philosophy of white supremacy. According to my sources, a small but far-reaching conspiracy exists within the U.S. military in support of this movement.
That is absurd.
I was followed here, Chief, by a man who had every intention of killing me. My rental car in Dallas was booby-trapped. I was attacked in the Dallas County Jail. They want me dead for a reason, sir. The threat is real. It's happening now. They stop in front of her vehicle. Ramming her pursuer's truck has left the front bumper and hood bashed. Pogue takes in the damage.
You're hell on rental cars, you know that, right?
Haley ignores his effort at levity. Or is it simply evasion? I need your help, sir. Whether it's that he was mugged in a Starbucks parking lot an hour earlier, or he has simply had enough of Haley's relentless pushing and prodding, Roy Pogue seems at the end of his rope with her.
What do you want from me? I investigate drug dealers and car thieves, maybe a sexual assault now and then. I chase homesick privates halfway across the state to their grandma's homes in Houston. What do you expect me to do about any of this other shit?
The deeper state operative is characteristically undeterred. General Killebrew, I'm following up on the military aspect of this thing. Pogue's head swings back and forth as if slapped.
Nope. No, 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 no.
My source in Dallas. The guy selling timeshares for treason. Haley pauses, considering how best to describe her interrogation methods. Decides that omission is the best strategy. He wouldn't talk. And then he did. Killebrew is at the top of this. All of which compels the CID agent to draw the proverbial line.
In no universe will I deliver up General Killebrew to you so that your crazy ass can accuse him of heading up a military-led secessionist movement. That, my friend, is not going to happen.
He climbs into the car. Haley does the same on the driver's side. Chief, I just want to talk to him.
Like every other poor motherfucker you've had a talk with? No, I'm not doing it.
Chief,
open your eyes, lady. Half the base is mobilizing for Operation Battle Cry. Killebrew doesn't have time for your shit.
Haley recalls the increased activity around the base and in town over the last couple of days. I saw a bunch of equipment on the highway and down by the rail yards.
Correct. What you're seeing is prep for the largest military exercise in Europe in 25 years. Participating units from Bliss, Hood, Stewart, and Fort Polk are loading vehicles, heavy equipment, and material for rail transport and onward shipping. 20,000 soldiers and that many pieces of equipment deploying from the United States bound for Europe. Kickoff was yesterday.
Haley ponders this news, then asks, Southeast?
Through San Antonio to the Port of Houston?
That's right, Port of Houston. Half a division is on the move.
Putting the pieces together inside her head, Haley doesn't like what she sees. With even more than her usual conviction, she says, "I've got to talk to the general."
"Take me to my car."
Pogue folds his arms across his chest, just as adamant. Haley had offered to return the CID agent to his car at the location of his mugging.
"Chief, drive, damn it! Take me back to my car!"
Not waiting for permission is standard operating procedure. In William Killebrew, Haley Chill's hunch is that she has found the apex of the conspiracy, the plot's architect and commander. Operation Battlecry is too convenient an opportunity. The war could be over before Washington even knows it started. Haley forwarded her 12-sentence report to Andrew Wilde and hopped in the car without waiting for an answer. She doesn't need help from Roy Pogue or the deeper state to find the general. On the first day of the monumental military exercise, there's only one place he's going to be. The Strauss Rail Yard, just outside Santa Teresa, New Mexico, is 20 miles northwest of El Paso, completed in 2014 as a modernization effort of the region's commercial transport infrastructure. The facility was designed with intermodal shipping, moving freight via two or more modes of transportation as its primary improvement over older existing facilities in the city. The transfer of 40-foot containers from truck to rail and onto ocean carriers is the most visible component of Operation Battlecry in the United States, representing a crucial test of the nation's ability to project a military presence anywhere in the world and in the shortest amount of time. Sighting of the Union Pacific facility in the open desert outside of tiny Santa Teresa and within a short driving distance to Fort Bliss was undoubtedly a significant consideration. Heading due west on the highway, Haley passes dozens of tractor-trailer rigs heading in the same direction. In the far right-hand lane, convoys of heavy-haul flatbed trailers loaded with M1 Abrams tanks, Bradley fighting vehicles, general-purpose Cougar Strikers, M-ATVs, and RG-31 armored trucks travel in a nearly continuous line toward the rail yards on the outskirts of Santa Teresa. Storm clouds continue to pile up and collide above the town's industrial landscape. Haley joins the convoy transitioning onto Airport Road, intersections under military police control, and heads north toward the intermodal facility and rail yards a few miles in that direction. Union Pacific security guards and military police protect the facility's gated entrance. Numerous other armed personnel patrol the tracks and surrounding area for miles, on foot and in expanded capacity M1113 Humvees. Pausing in her vehicle on Airport Road outside the rail yard's main gate, Haley assesses the security presence and realizes her chances of gaining unauthorized entry are close to nil. With nothing to lose, the deeper state operative pulls into the visitor's entry driveway, separate from the entrance used by freight-bearing tractor trailers lining the road behind her. The gate is down, denying entry. A uniformed Union Pacific police officer steps up to Haley's open window while another, with a guard dog on a short leash, performs a walk-around of the car. Two military policemen hang back, maintaining their position at the gate. The UP man says, "Sorry, ma'am, no visitors." Haley has her identification ready, including her Senate credentials Wilde had provided her within 24 hours of her arrival in Texas. "I'm Haley Chill, aide to Senator Powell on the Committee on Armed Services, here on oversight."
"Well, ma'am, I don't care if you're here on cocaine. You're not coming on facility premises without prior authorization."
Haley isn't willing to let it go, not so easily. "Look, if you just call..." The security guard steps back, putting a hand on a Glock 22 in its holster on his equipment belt. A trio of military police approach the car, their M4 carbines pointed down at the ground, but ready.
"There a problem here?" asks one of the MPs.
The UP officer, a veteran of the Fort Worth Police Department, ignores his military counterpart.
"Turn around, ma'am, or you will be arrested for trespassing. The entire facility is on lockdown for the duration of the Army's load-in."
Haley says nothing but pleads her case with those powder blue eyes. The Union Pacific officer is immune to her appeal.
"Ma'am, I advise you to turn your car around and go. We just sent a TV news team from KTSM up to Doña Ana County Detention Center 30 minutes ago."
Santa Teresa isn't much of a town.
not nearly as sweetly spiritual as its name implies. Thanks to Union Pacific's move from East El Paso to the new facility on Airport Road, the entire municipality is one massive warehouse after another, a grid of tan office buildings erected seemingly overnight in a once-empty expanse of sand and sagebrush. Many of these warehouses contain raw materials awaiting transport over the nearby border to factories in Mexico. The finished products are moved north again and stored in these very same warehouses before loading onto trains for shipment all over the United States. Haley stops at Penny's Diner, which shares a large parking lot with a travel lodge on Airport Road. A little before 5 p.m., the joint is almost empty. She chooses a booth farthest from the front door next to the restrooms. A waitress, Haley's age, with a cheerful manner and eager to please, approaches with a carafe of coffee. She wordlessly holds it aloft, and the deeper state operative nods.
"Figured. You had that gimme coffee look,"
the waitress says as she snags a cup and saucer, placing them on the table in front of Haley.
"Fixins?"
"Black is fine, thank you."
"Long day?"
asks the waitress.
"You could say that.
Long week."
The other young woman nods sympathetically.
"Eating?"
"Just coffee for now. If I change my mind, I'll let you know."
The waitress smiles and turns to attend to other duties.
Haley watches her go, reflecting on the utter grace of people. Some people. With precious little conversation, the other woman intuited exactly what Haley needed, and all with a kind smile. Perfect. She ponders the beauty of that uncomplicated human interaction. Haley indulges a moment of envying the other woman. With full awareness, she's being delusional in doing so. But Haley comprehends nothing of the waitress's actual life, the full spectrum that may include dissatisfactions and unhappiness. Makes no difference. Not while enjoying the brief moment of their simple, elegant exchange. Haley had entered the cafe in a low mood, in full retreat after her recent setback. That weight has at least partially lifted. Checking her phone, she finds no message from Andrew Wilde in response to her concerns regarding the massive military exercise. As outlandish as her suspicions might seem, Haley now suspects the secessionists intend to take advantage of Operation Battlecry and combine elements of the 1st Armored Division with the Texas Army National Guard 72nd Brigade as an occupying force of the Permian Basin. But the railway route to the port in Houston passes hundreds of miles south of Midland and the ARNG deployment. Is she being paranoid? What real evidence does she possess that might convince Wilde and her superiors in Publius of the imminent danger? Despite her successes in climbing the Cabal's chain of command, Haley has learned almost nothing about Tommy Chill's role, why he stole Charlie Hicks's identity, what compelled him to abandon his family. After only a few minutes of sitting in the booth and staring out the window that faces Airport Road, Haley sees a Humvee pull into the lot. Three officers exit the vehicle and stroll toward the cafe's entrance. Though the two men and one woman wear the same combat uniform in camo pattern, the oldest among them, walking a pace in front, has unmistakable authority over the others. No matter how subdued the grade insignia, his two stars embroidered on a matching camouflage pattern are impossible to miss. General Killebrew's cranium seems as if carved from an oak stump. Haley doesn't think she has seen a more massive head in her life. Coarse gray bristle emerges from below the bottom of the general's camouflage field cap, ending with a sharp edge at the base of his neck. With long arms swinging confidently, punctuated by enormous, pendulous hands, the general's gait is simultaneously adamant and jagged. Killebrew is a born warrior, someone who would be at home on the fields of Thermopylae, at Babawali Pass, on Porkchop Hill. Haley watches the army officers approach the door. Denied entry to the rail yard where she had hoped to find the general, she only needed a coffee stop at Penny's Diner for William Killebrew to come to her. The smile, Haley muses. The waitress's friendly greeting was an act of grace. Killebrew and his staff officers enter the cafe and take the first booth by the entrance. Haley cannot make out much of their subdued conversation. They're talking shop, that much is obvious. The logistics of Operation Battlecry require Herculean management attention. Haley surmises that Killebrew and his staff have escaped to the quiet confines of Penny's Diner for some privacy to confer. pouring coffee for the officers. The waitress glances in her direction. Haley nods, their wordless communication continuing unabated. With her coffee cup refreshed, she locks her gaze on Killebrew at the other end of the room, deep in conversation with his two staff officers. The .45-caliber Warhawk rides comfortably on her strong side, inside the waistband holster. What she doesn't have is a plan. But there's no way Killebrew is leaving the premises without a confrontation. Haley Chill will wait for her moment. That opportunity comes soon enough. After the army officers have ordered, Killebrew stands up from the booth and walks in Haley's direction, heading to the restroom, she assumes. The deeper state operative weighs the timing of her challenging Killebrew in the next few seconds. How will his junior officers react? Are they even aware of the storm and its agenda? She feels her pulse quicken and works to control it. Calm is needed. Calculation. Follow him into the men's restroom. Confront him there. Haley resists the urge to study the general more closely, keeping her eyes locked forward. She feels the general's gaze fall on her briefly as he passes her in the booth. But he doesn't turn left toward the restrooms. Instead, Killebrew continues past Haley's booth and exits the diner through a rear emergency door. Haley remains motionless for a beat, looking toward the two junior officers at the other end of the diner. They converse quietly as if nothing is amiss. Do they even know the general has left the premises? Is he coming back? She doesn't want to lose her chance to interrogate Killebrew. She can't allow that to happen, not when she's so close. Sliding out of the booth, Haley glances toward the other end of the room. Confirming that the two junior officers remain seated, Haley turns and exits through the same emergency door Killebrew exited. Stepping outside, she feels her hair grasped and wrenched backward. Haley loses consciousness, for seconds only, as the back of her skull slams against the metal doorframe. Despite her incapacitation, the deeper state operative fully comprehends what is happening. Though she has yet to see her assailant, Haley knows it must be Killebrew who has her hair in his grip. She can intuit his sheer size. Her training kicks in. Haley reaches for the Warhawk, and her fingers touch the empty IWB holster. Killebrew has her gun. With his massive fingers gripping her hair, the general wrenches Haley's head down and around, putting an unnatural torque on her upper vertebrae, and then propels her across what must be the rear parking lot. In his lumberjack's grip, she is utterly in his control. Her mind races as Killebrew bum-rushes her to God knows where. So far, Haley and the general have exchanged no words. Just the assault and then being dragged across the parking lot. Recalling that the cafe shares its parking lot with a budget motel, Haley wonders how her abduction can be happening without witnesses. Where is everyone? He was born and raised in New Hampshire. His father, Jack, was a teacher at the high school. An only child and unusually introverted, William Killebrew was closer to his mother, Carol, a deeply religious homemaker. More at ease prowling in the woods than engaging in the normal teenage activities of his peers, a 13-year-old William was devastated by the shocking breakup of his parents' marriage, challenging his father in the driveway of the family home, one which the elder Killebrew would never set foot in again. The teenager did not receive the answers he desperately needed to hear. Why was he leaving the family? What possibly could justify this unpardonable betrayal of mother and son? William resorted to surveilling his dad until the source of the breakup was uncovered. Jack Killebrew had fallen in love with a fellow teacher at the high school. This warm and vivacious black woman was the polar opposite of his soon-to-be ex-wife in every way imaginable. William's mother soon left for North Carolina, taking her only son with her. She remarried. Her new husband, the single father to a boy 11 years younger than William and the sibling he always wanted. For Carol, there was no greater priority in life than indoctrinating both sons, biological and step, with her fiery racist beliefs. William Killebrew carried that extreme xenophobic ideology with him through high school and afterward while attending West Point. Cautious in revealing these hatreds, Killebrew served his country with honor. But waiting for the opportunity to bring his ideas into the open and make them a reality.
The general stands 6 feet 4 inches tall, with shoulders like a crucifix's crosspiece. His eyes blaze with belief in a cause that can only be just. Kicking open the gate to the trash bin enclosure at the edge of the rear parking lot, he flings Haley Chill to the ground inside, as if she were Azazel, a fallen angel. Knocked semi-conscious again, Haley attempts to focus her eyes on the giant standing over her. The Warhawk is in his right hand, pointed at her. Killebrew says,
"You don't even know."
His voice is hoarse, perennially, she's sure. A soldier's voice blown out in battle, from making order of chaos.
"You killed him, damn you. You killed my only brother."
Haley has been a witness to several deaths in the last week. She can only remember killing 3 men, the AWOL soldiers at the New Mexico compound. His brother was one of them? "How?" she asks.
"Christ, I saw you coming from a mile away."
He takes a less casual aim on her.
"You've caused enough trouble."
"Your brother?" she asks, buying time. "Devise a plan, something."
"Cecil Drummond, my stepbrother."
Haley's expression reveals enough to tell him that he was right about one thing. She didn't know. Despite his father's betrayal, William Killebrew found solace in the combined family provided by his mother's second marriage, with the mentoring of a younger stepbrother. As much as his limited emotional boundaries allow, Killebrew loved Cecil Drummond. He rescued him from his numerous legal troubles and gave him a new sense of purpose in the noble cause of creating a better and thoroughly white nation.
"Tortured him, then chased him to his death."
Haley feels a moment of sheer desperation that she struggles to dampen, and also some shame with the extreme measures she had taken. Calmly, she says, "One of your people placed the bomb in that car. Not me."
"What does that matter?"
he asks. Killebrew's smile is mostly a sneer, confessing a propensity for sadism. Will this be for pleasure or revenge? His finger curves around the trigger, applying the necessary pressure to initiate the mechanism's pre-travel sequence. Only the slightest additional force is needed to engage the 1911's mainspring. That is, when things go boom. A man's voice interjects first.
"General?"
Haley's gaze lands first, a split second before Killebrew's. CID agent Roy Pogue in his two-piece suit is a welcome sight, a familiar face in an otherwise hellacious ordeal. Pogue speaks again, his voice firmer.
"Sir, what is this?"
Killebrew's expression is mostly one of embarrassed consternation, as if he's been caught masturbating. Haley seizes on this opportunity provided by her attacker's fluster.
"Chief, please, help me!"
Now the general grins, enjoying her plight. The fire in his eyes undiminished, only heightened.
"Help you?" Killebrew barks a laugh. "How do you think I knew what you looked like? Who gave me a photo of you?"
Haley stares incredulously at the CID agent, unable to process the reality of what Killebrew is saying. The general says,
"In the new order of things, they get their own country. Gulf States, Louisiana. They recognize the need for separation just like we do."
"They?" Pogue has no issue with meeting her gaze. There's a hardness in his eyes. Generations of indignities and humiliations earned him that much. He says,
"I told you to stop."
Killebrew gestures toward the enclosure gate that Pogue had pushed open as he entered.
"Close that damn thing. Let's finish this."
The general takes aim again on Haley with her own gun. Almost softly, Pogue says,
"No."
He has drawn his SIG P320, holding it out and grasped with both hands. The sight picture is Killebrew's enormous Frankenstein head. In the tight confines of the dumpster enclosure, less than 6 feet separate the two men.
"My God, soldier, are you fucking insane?"
asks Killebrew, swinging the warhawk around and gun blasts cracking almost simultaneously. He was a middling football player and slightly above average student. Raised in Sunnyside, a neighborhood south of downtown Houston, Roy Pogue mostly avoided trouble and the gangs that infested the community. Enlisting in the U.S. Army after graduation from high school, he continued to make concerted efforts to better himself. Soon after basic and occupational training, Pogue applied to join the military police and then Criminal Investigation Division Command. In the Army, his closest buddy was another guy from the neighborhood, Micah Johnson, a more charismatic individual, Batman to Pogue's Robin. Both Johnson and Pogue attained ranks of sergeant, with Micah opting for straight infantry. Frustrated in his pursuit of advancement and at the mercy of hostile, mostly white superiors, Johnson grew increasingly radicalized in his political beliefs. A girlfriend introduced him to the Israelite Church of God in Jesus Christ, an organization of Black Hebrew Israelites that the Southern Poverty Law Center has labeled an active hate group that espouses black supremacist beliefs. Always the follower, Roy Pogue joined his friend at the twice-weekly services held in the living room of a local priest of the controversial church. The CID agent embraced the sect's ideas of 10 lost tribes and black superiority more out of loyalty than for anything resembling conviction. Several years passed. Pogue remained on the political movement's fringes. Many of the church's followers drifted away from active participation. Pogue would have lost interest, too, were it not for his close friendship with Micah, whose radicalization had only increased. The police shooting deaths of two local black teens finally triggered the most virulent form of this extremism. A planned protest of police violence in Dallas inspired the Army sergeant to go cop hunting. In a rare act of defiance, Pogue refused to join Johnson. After killing five police officers in a gun rampage, Micah Johnson was shot and mortally injured by members of Dallas SWAT unit. Following his best friend's death, Pogue recommitted himself wholeheartedly to the principles of black nationalism and the Israelite Church of God in Jesus Christ. Haley gets to her knees and looks to her left, toward the felled giant. The blood pooling rapidly beneath his face suggests a shot to the head. So does the missing left backside of his skull. No one has ever been more dead than this guy. She lifts her gaze and pivots, looking behind her, to where Roy Pogue sits on the ground near the enclosure's gate. Shoulders slumped and chin nearly on his chest, the CID agent plants his hands on the stained pavement at either side. The SIG 320 lies at his feet. Haley retrieves the warhawk from the ground next to Killebrew's corpse. First things first, then crawls to where Pogue sits. She sees no blood on the CID agent. Chief, are you hit? His head comes up, engaged now, like a ventriloquist's dummy. All muscles slack except in the jaw. Pogue is determined to speak.
Killebrew? He asks.
Dead. Headshot.
Pogue nods, satisfied. Not to be ugly, but kinda hard to miss.
Haley smiles despite the circumstances. That the warrant officer saved her life is a jewel to be admired later. Assess the situation, then act on that assessment. Mr. Pogue, tell me where you're hurt. Growing weaker, he moves his head back and forth. Only then does Haley see the blood seeping through his shirt to his suit jacket. She reaches to render medical assistance, to do something. The CID agent pushes her hands away.
Enough.
He's going to die, and knows it. Why did you help me? She asks. Pogue struggles to sit up, grimaces, and settles back again.
Anything to put it to these racist fucks.
Including you, right? Haley asks pointedly. His smile vaporizes.
Baby.
Then.
Funny what hate can do to a man.
She follows his gaze to where the general's body lies face down on the filthy cement.
And on a high note, right?
Asks Pogue. Indeed. Haley regrets lumping the CID agent in with the likes of Killebrew. You stopped it. It's over.
No, not over. Everything in motion. Only Woodside has the whole thing in his head. Only him.
Woodside? Killebrew wasn't the top?
Pogue shakes his head no. Take my phone. Go. Don't stop.
Though he knows he doesn't have to tell her of all people, he does so anyway. He says,
never stop.
The CID agent reaches into his suit jacket pocket and offers his smartphone to her.
9966. Everything you need is on that phone.
She takes the phone. Why, sir? Why did you help me? Does he even know why?
Maybe I'm just so tired.
Haley has seen enough men die to know Roy Pogue's time is close. The question she has raised at each rung of the ladder must be asked. Did you know Tommy Chill? He was involved in all of this. Maybe went by the name of Charlie Hicks, worked at the Pentagon. Did you know him, Chief? But the light in Pogue's eyes is mostly extinguished. Talking has taken such an effort. He no longer feels the cold of lurking death, replaced by a surging, warm glow. There is goodness still in these last few moments of life. Peace. Despite the stench emanating from the dumpster bins and grease-stained pavement under his hands, Roy Pogue can almost smile. For real. Experiencing the heady rush of grace. Of making amends.
9966.